Far away. Welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show. John C. McGinley just sat down, comfortable. We played 12, 13 holes of golf.
There you go. You want to do a sound check first?
Haven't even done a sound check.
Gaily bedight, a gallant knight in sunshine and in shadow, had journeyed long, singing a song in search of El Dorado. But he grew old, this knight so bold, and o'er his heart a shadow. Fell as he found no spot of ground that looked like El Dorado. And as his strength failed him at length, he met a pilgrim shadow. Shadow, said he, where can it be, this land of El Dorado? Over the mountains of the moon, down the valley of the shadow, ride, boldly ride, the shade replied, if you seek for El Dorado.
And podcast done. I think that's, I've never finished a podcast in 38 seconds, but I think we just
did. With an Edgar Allan Poe poem.
That was really good. John, how do you describe yourself to people who, in an elevator, who don't know your wonderful career as a character actor?
As a character actor?
Do you call yourself that?
First, I would call myself a special needs advocate, and then I would call myself a working actor who's done almost 100 films and 400 hours of television, a couple of Broadway plays, almost a dozen off-Broadway plays. I'm a guy who's made a living being a storyteller.
I love that. I love that. I think we got a ginger ale flying in. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, dear. Cheers. Great to see you, Mary.
Great to see you, too.
Well, first we'll describe where we're at. We are at one of the, I think this is a very long table, but I think it's the second longest table I've ever recorded a podcast on. We've got about 2, 4, 5, seating for about 12 people at this table, tufted leather swivel chairs. We're in the upper boardroom of the Sherwood par 3 course, Little Sherwood you called it.
I do.
We're here because you love golf, along with
acting. I do love golf. I like golf because, like being a storyteller, and for those of us who do have, not clinically diagnosed, but a civilian version of obsessive compulsive, in between gigs, if you're not memorizing lines and trying to marshal 165 people in the right direction, like on a TV or a movie set, as either the producer or the producer actor, you're going to have a lot of energy left on the sidelines.
Right.
What are you going to do with that? And so if that is sprayed around the house in a micromanaging capacity, it's not going to float. You're going to be least popular guy in class. And so I found that aside from surfing, which is a very different discipline than golf, but golf will absorb all the obsessive compulsive you want to pour into it. All of it. It'll take all of it. And then some.
So, and how, what does that actually mean? Do you mean like obsessing over, like when we played just now, you were like, talking about swing path and coming in too steep or whatever that is. Like you're talking about the swing itself?
Yes. That because it's such a process, the whole stinking thing is a process. And I'm largely okay with that just because I'm process driven as an actor and as a storyteller. That's not unfamiliar or frightening to me, that is a process, and that the immediate gratification of it all is largely not going to happen.
Yeah. So when did you start playing golf?
I was a caddy my whole life, and so I didn't start playing golf till way too late. I would say about 15 years ago.
Oh, wow. And you were born in 59?
I was born in 59.
59.
And
you were born on my wedding day, August 3rd.
Nice.
I'm divorced.
Same with Marty Sheen.
And my parents' wedding day. Martin Sheen's birthday? That's his birthday?
Yep.
No way.
And so I grew up being a caddy. I grew up first in New York City, and then we moved up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and then Dad finally settled in Short Hills, New Jersey, which is this beautiful suburb of New York. And there's a club, a town over in Springfield, New Jersey, which is a world championship course called Baldisrol. And my father was a member there, and my brothers and I all grew up caddying there. And
at the time, it was as famous as it is now.
Absolutely.
And it still had two courses. It was the whole deal.
Absolutely.
Do you know, did you ever hear that story about how it got its name?
No.
Colt, will you look that up?
Baldisrol.
Yes. It was a murder. A guy named Baldisrol was murdered or something.
I absolutely do not know this story.
I don't know the story. We'll look it up. But, I mean, it is, I don't know of many courses that are named after a dude that, oh, no sell. Let's go get some cell service. Let's
the
go
cell
get some,
service here.
Let's
is
log
the
into
worst.
That Wi-Fi and get this. I want to hear that story because I mean, I grew up in Madison, two towns over from Short Hills. Never being into golf, I guess maybe similar to you, even though you caddied. What was it like? So you didn't play?
Absolutely not.
But you caddied
nonstop.
Were you a full judgmental caddy?
No, because the members there are really rough and they're very fanatical, and they play. They're all big bettors. And so I was pretty nimble as a caddy with different members. I knew what different members. I mean, the learning curve is pretty steep.
That probably is a almost like a defining trait of an actor, being able to just judge people and immediately get on their level.
Yeah, and also back then it was $25 a bag. I think it's $100 a bag now.
Whoa!
And so you wanted that 25 plus 5 or 10, and you know, that morning could yield you $60 cash, no taxes taken out.
Right.
That's not a bad morning. You know, if it wasn't the fall when it was football or something, although we'd caddy on Sunday, that was a good $60 is good.
All right, so we got the history of Baltus Roll. History. Baltus Roll Golf Club was named after Baltus Roll, 1769, and died in 1831, who farmed the land on which the club resides today. In 1831... he was murdered at age 61 on February 22nd by two thieves who believed that he had hidden a small treasure in his farmhouse on Baltus Roll Mountain.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, poor guy.
If my brothers know that.
Baltus Roll, and his last name is spelled R-O-L-L.
Oh, that's been truncated.
So now it is just R-O-L. You have members there? Still?
My brother Jerry's still a member.
Oh, cool.
And so when I go back east, Jerry is always nice enough to host us there, and that's pretty special.
I mean, he's your brother.
Yeah, but still, you know, you got to leave work for a day, and it's right. Pretty special when Jerry can work that out.
Did you ever, side note, Short Hills Mall, did you ever go there? Was that around when you were there?
Yeah, but it wasn't my thing.
Because the Short Hills Mall is the sister mall to the Beverly Center. And so when I came to L.A., I went into the Beverly Center, and I was like, this is weird. I've already been to this mall. And then...
it's a little bit of a poker tell that you hang out in malls.
Come on.
It's a little bit of a tell.
I don't hang out in malls.
It's a pattern. You've just said I've been to brother and sister malls. I've never heard a straight guy say that in my life. So what's going on?
I'm a product of, you know, the 80s. You know, like I'm a product of the Kevin Smith generation, Clerks. You know, we go to malls to hang out. Where did you hang out as a kid? Did you hang out at the 7-Eleven? What did you do on a Friday night at 18 after caddying?
Tried to get a kiss. It's what every straight guy tries to do.
Trying to get a kiss. Where would you do that? Because we're talking late 70s, right?
Yeah, I was class of 78 and at Milburn High School.
Did you get a car? Milburn High. What did your parents do? When did you get a car? I want a picture.
I didn't have a car. You were allowed to use dad's car if you dropped him off at the station in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
He was a stockbroker. He was a stockbroker. And so that meant you were getting out of bed around 5:30 and getting him down to the Erie Lackawanna train line that went into New York and it went into Hoboken. And so if you got out of bed and drove dad down there, you could use the car for the day, but you also had to pick him up. And that is where the phrase, if you can't be on time, be early, came from. And so, and that's, in retrospect, it's fair enough. If you put in a long day in the New York Stock Exchange and your jackass 18-year-old son can't be there at, we'll make it up, 6:15 at night to pick you up, that's not acceptable.
Oh, I would be fuming.
I would too.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is incur that wrath once.
Yeah.
And you were there. Plus, he had one of those old Camaros that had way too much engine in it, but nothing on the outside.
Right.
Just a basic outside package with maybe 450 under the hood. And the thing was a rocket ship.
Well, and all the roads in this neighborhood are super, they're both good and bad, right?
Yes. They're very windy and narrow,
yeah,
and fun to drive.
But dangerous.
You could wrap around a tree with just in a millisecond.
So many trees. But you're just caddying. I'm just trying to picture this because I hated golf until just 7 or 8 years ago, and now it's my life. But you didn't hate golf. You just didn't care.
I really was obsessed with football and baseball and track and athletics.
I mean, you're a very athletic person, so you were just...
I didn't equate golf with those disciplines. Of course it is. It's close to impossible, except if you're a seven. And I just didn't... It didn't occur to me. It didn't occur to me. I just wanted to lift and get fast and be a better... track and field athlete and be a better wide receiver and good enough to be crushed by Madison.
He's referring to our New Jersey rivalry, the Madison Dodgers versus the...
Dodgers better than us.
What was the team? What was the name of your team?
First it was the Milburn Millers, right. And then, which is largely what they should have adhered to, because there is a mill, the paper mill,
right.
Playhouse.
I remember that.
Milburn. So we should have been the Millers, and then somebody changed us to the Milburn Bears.
No Bears. So when did you decide that you wanted to be an actor?
Pretty early on.
Because you made me think of a paper mill playhouse.
I would say by the time I was a sophomore, I went to Ohio Wesleyan first year, and... When I realized at Ohio Wesleyan, I ran the radio station with a guy named Kevin Miller, and I realized I really wanted to be in a storytelling capacity, whether that was journalism or sports broadcasting. And to do that, you should be at Syracuse at Newhouse.
You would have been a great sports broadcaster.
I was, but when I got there as a sophomore, all the copy that you write is for upperclassmen,
right?
And so I'm writing reams and reams of copy. It just was unacceptable to me that if I wrote it, I didn't get to say it. And so, what it did reveal is that I really was on track to be a storyteller. And so if you want to be a storyteller, which is what I call actors, you really have to either be at Yale, NYU, or Juilliard.
Right.
And I applied to NYU undergrad. I got in, and I was there for 2 years. No, I was there for a year undergrad. And it was too big, and it was too silly. And so out of a total act of arrogance, as a junior, I applied to the grad school. And they accept 2 people a year from undergrad. And the deal is, we'll take you as a junior, but just so you understand, there's an automatic attrition rate. Every year, we cut 15.
Whoa.
So we'll accept 45. 2 of you will be underclassmen. After 2 years, you'll get a bachelor's. But if you get kicked out at any time, you get nothing.
You lose everything.
You lose everything. And I was just like, well, you're not kicking me out. In fact, you're going to pay for me to come to your school, which they did. I was just like, this is how this is going to go.
Right.
And I don't know what that was born out of, other than I knew I had to do this. I knew what I had to do. It was clear as day.
Right.
And for some reason, I read Alec Baldwin's book, and Alec said that he, for some reason, thought he could do this.
Right.
And obviously he was right. I felt the same way. And I tell actors, I work with young actors all the time, when they come out and they tell me they have a plan B, I just tell them, please, please do the plan B, because it's going to be so much better. It's going to be better.
What?
The plan B, if you have a plan B, it's going
to... Like going to business school?
Dude, go to business school.
Why?
It's going to be better.
No, being an
actor,
how?
Because being an actor is impossible.
You have a lot of friends that have failed?
Sure.
Because how would you characterize your outcome?
Absurd.
Success.
Yeah, but that's insane.
Why? Well, sure, but I mean...
No, you should do something, unless you have to do... I'm reminded of a story that was ingrained in my head. Up at Syracuse, the 1 year I was there, because it's so cold, I don't know if you've ever been up there, but the school's on a hill, and Lake Onondaga, I think, is right below it. And so it's the same as Chicago. When it freezes over, the lake effect, the wind blows across and it hits the side of the hill where Syracuse is with supercharged cold air.
Yeah.
And so once the cold comes, you can't like go outside for a jog or do physical fitness. You have to do something indoors. So I decided I would try fighting. I would box.
Right.
And so I found a gym down in Syracuse, and I'd run off down the hill. And I had this guy who would, you know, if you pay him $15 a day to let you use the gym, he would also, he'd coach you up and tell you where your elbow should be and the whole routine. And so I started to get pretty good at it, at training, at boxing.
Yeah.
I got fast and strong. And he, about 4 months in, towards the springtime, he said, you want to spar with somebody? I'm like, absolutely. And I was about 182. And 82 is where the light heavyweights and the heavy welterweights are, which is where the freaks are.
Yeah.
And so think of Andrew Holyfield before he became a heavyweight. So that's who the 182s are. So you put the headgear on, and this guy, I was staying away from him for about, I don't know, 2.5 minutes or so. And then he just hit me with a body shot, just a right to my liver, and it buckled me. And I immediately knew that unless you have to do this, you shouldn't. And I feel the same way about acting, that unless you have to do it, definitely do something else. I had to do this. I had to. There was no possible way this wasn't going to work out.
Hmm.
Whatever metric that looked like, there was an Irish willfulness that I imposed on this. And I got really lucky, and I trained my ass off and came up with a toolkit, an actor's toolkit of ways to deconstruct a script and ways to fit into a narrative, which have become indispensable.
Right. So when you are, but is there some element of when you're telling people to go do the alternate? Are you also sort of doing the reverse psychology?
No, absolutely not.
Because don't you want them to be an actor and be successful?
No.
Don't you want that?
No. I want them. If I want them to have a fulfilling, stimulating life, instead of just being the object of rejection, which is what you're going to be,
even at your level.
No, but on the way up.
Right. When did it stop mattering to you, the feeling of rejection?
After the financial windfall that was Scrubs.
Right.
But on the way up, if you're selling keychains as a keychain salesman, and you're not, it's not going well. At night, every night when you get home, when you look at the man in the mirror, you can reconcile the failure by something wrong with the keychain, not wrong with you. It can be the product. When you get rejected as an actor, we're rejecting you. We're doing the film. Just not with you. And so the reason that's tricky is that you can get really good at getting tough skin and leathery skin that can fight off rejection. However, there's a price. And if you get too leathery emotionally, you lose your loveliness and you lose whatever magic you had that made you interesting. Because now you can put up with rejection and your fists up and rejection's not going to bother you. But that's not what makes you lovely. What makes you lovely is whatever that vulnerability was that got tarred over, it got asphalted over by all that rejection. Look, when I got out of school in 84, I went right into a play. 2 weeks before I graduated, I was understudying John Turturro in Danny the Deep Blue Sea. So I had employment. But... and that was $318 a week to make up John's hands and call the house and then make up June. It's a two-hander. And
that's a lot of money.
No, it's not.
No? No. More than caddying.
I was making that a night at Mary Lou's. I was making $500 a night and then paying the bar and the bus and walking with, $325 a night.
Okay.
So to stop working at Mary Lou's on 9th Street between 5th and 6th, right when you get off the path train there, I had to do it. Otherwise, and the reason I had to do it is A, I got to play, and B, you'd be de-incentivized to go to the 7th audition that day.
Right.
Well, you have to go to the 7th audition for Tide,
yeah,
for Colgate Palmolive. You have to go to that.
Because you never know, or because it's just...
No,
it's,
because that's what you have to do.
You just have to do it.
You don't know anything.
Right.
You're not going to get it, but you got to grind.
It sounds awful. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could do auditions.
Well, you have to get good at them. They're just like putting. You can get good at auditions. That doesn't mean you're going to get the job, but you can get good at that 2.5-3 minute discipline.
Which is like, what's the main characteristic that needs to be flexed in an audition?
Really quick study.
Okay. Of the people in the room or what they want?
Of the text, what's on the page.
Ah, okay.
And then next level would be quick study of what's on the page and what's in the room. And then I made up this concept called Elvis Dust. And
Elvis Presley.
Yeah, Elvis Dust.
Elvis Dust.
And Elvis Dust, I was Oliver Stone's reader. So when you came into audition for Oliver, you had your script, and the person you were reading with wasn't the casting director. The three people in the room were the casting director, Oliver, the four people were the guy operating the camera, Oliver, the casting person, and me.
And was this before you worked with him a lot?
No, this was after Wall Street.
Yeah, this is just your...
Two films.
He's just like, come and hang.
Yeah, come and do me a favor. And so I'm like, yeah, if you keep putting me in movies, I'll do you whatever. And he put me in six, so it all worked out.
It's a good number.
And so, one better than your handicap. and so actors would come in, and I developed this concept that I called Elvis Dust. And what it means is, and it's applicable to any business, but for actors particularly, actors come in the room, and a lot of times the first thing they'd say to Oliver, and I'm sitting over here, Oliver's here, I'm on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And I want you to succeed, because I love actors, and I know how hard walking in this room with Oliver Stone is. And I'm sitting over here, and I see you come in, and the first thing out of your mouth is that you haven't had a chance to read the script because your aunt died down in Philadelphia a week ago, and you had to go to the wake last night, and you just took the train up this morning, and so all the air is coming out of the balloon.
Yeah, and everyone is expecting you to fail now, or what is
no,
that?
No,
you're
subverting everything, and I call that pig pen. And so, you know, like in Peanuts, when that guy has the dirt that precedes him and follows
Linus?
Him everywhere? No, pig pen.
Oh, that's pig pen, right.
And so I call that pig pen. And so sometimes actors bring in pig pen, and I just cringe. And then other times, actors bring in Elvis Dust. And Elvis Dust is a combination of, and you can't fabricate it. If you could, it would be the gold stuff. But it's a combination of self-esteem, preparation, being in the right room at the right time, and luck. And preparation's no small part of this, but it's also self-esteem, just you're feeling just on top of the world.
Right.
And that stuff is contagious. And I call it Elvis Dust because when you bring it in, like I brought it in on 7 when I met David Fincher on 7. I had Elvis Dust all over me. I don't know why. But that role of California was written for a Latin male. And the producer, who Arnold Copelson, rest in peace, who just passed, who also produced Platoon, and that's why he brought me in to meet David Fincher, to play this great little featured role in that film, he just brought me in because he's one of the great guys. But it was written for a Latin man, male. And I just had Elvis Dust all over me. And when you have Elvis Dust on you, people want to they want to rub up against it a little bit.
Right.
They want to get some on them. And when actors bring in Elvis Dust, it's a whole different game. It's fascinating.
So, I mean, I need to ask, how does one increase their odds of acquiring Elvis Dust at the right moment?
You can't, other than just over-preparing and over-delivering.
Because, I mean, Elvis Dust, great for an audition, also great for a nerve-wracking first tee shot.
No question.
What do you think is the most important thing in playing good golf?
One or two thoughts over the ball. One or two clear thoughts about whatever your teacher told you. Just one or two clear thoughts instead of, I'm going to whack this really hard, or I'm gonna take 10% off this. For 12s, I can't take 10% off a swing. I don't know how to do that. And so just a clear thought, a shoulder turn. I'm going to really rotate my shoulders this time and swing.
Right.
That's all. That's all I have. I'm not at the next level where these other guys are. And so I want one or two really clear, useful thoughts. Really just one.
Yeah. That's ideal. The fewer, the better. So, who do you have to thank for getting you into golf? Because, you know, you spend your life around golf, and then what happens 15 years ago is to get you into playing?
I moved out here.
Yeah.
But
you moved out here in the 80s, 90s, right?
No, I moved out here. I moved out here late.
Late 90s?
I suppose around 93 or so.
Okay. All right.
And when I came out here, where I lived, there used to be a course right up on the side of the mountain.
Right.
And people would say, come up and play. And it was only 11 minutes from the house. And the price point was around $27. And I just started to really enjoy it, making contact with the ball.
So you just went out basically out of you were in between gigs.
Yes.
And you were like, well, I'm free, save for a couple auditions here and there. Or were you even doing auditions at this time?
Oh, absolutely.
At what point do you ever stop doing auditions?
I don't think you ever would. Like if Marty Scorsese or some Hall of Famer said, we'd love to see John for a certain movie, I damn sure go in an audition. But otherwise, no, you'd be good and goddamn lucky to have me on your set.
Fist bump. That is so legit. That, I think, I just...
And believe me, that's not born out of arrogance.
I think that's what Elvis dust smells like.
Yes.
That's awesome, dude. So, okay, but back to the golf. So you get into the golf. You're basically just... people are just inviting you out. And you're like, I'll try
mostly
this.
Mostly up to the course on the side of the hill. And... I thought it was great, and it felt impossible. I knew everything about the game as a caddy.
Yeah,
I didn't know how to execute, but I knew distances. I can read a green in my sleep. But then swinging that club, and it just became really hard. Like, we were in the Philippines doing platoon, and I wasn't playing golf by then, and that was 86, so... A bunch of guys were playing golf back then, but I wasn't one of them. So
in the Philippines?
Yeah, we were staying in a place called Puerto Azul, where this guy named Ferdinand Marcos, who was the president of the Philippines, had built it for visiting friends. And it was kind of this resort about 2 hours outside Manila. And that's where we were housed during the jungle sequences.
Okay.
And so we lived there for about 3 months. And a bunch of guys were... playing golf and stuff, but I don't ever remember going and playing golf.
So, and then, because I guess I'm just so curious, because as a, you know, at the time you're surfing, I'm assuming all the time.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking about surfing being so different from golf, and are you, must be, what on earth happened in a round of golf for you to stop going surfing and just start playing golf more?
Well, surfing has a condition. There has to be a bump. And so if it's Lake Pacific, then you ain't surfing.
Lake Pacific.
And so, you know, you just come over here. And again, you can pour all that obsessive compulsive into Sherwood.
I love it.
Because no one's ever here.
Yeah.
So, and I play by myself largely. I'm saying largely too much. I mostly play by myself because I like it.
The editor, Johnny C.
And... I'll play the first ball I hit, and then if it wasn't what I wanted, I'll try to groove five or six more. They don't count, but you have to play the first to submit the handicap. But there's no one behind you to bug you,
right?
And there's no one in front of you so it's heaven to me.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful piece of property. We played golf and we filmed a lot of it, so you can get a view of that. Let's take a. Johnny, I made cookies, and I haven't made cookies on the podcast in a while, so I don't know if you eat cookies, but either way, we can take a break, and you can have one if you want, or you can turn it down. What do you think you're going to do?
Well, if you made them, I got to try them.
You can have a bite.
But we don't have to take a break.
But we can't. Well, we're not supposed to eat on the podcast. A lot of people gave me shit for that, and I found that he's eating. He doesn't give a shit.
No, you can't possibly care if people give you shit for eating on the podcast.
I do care. Why do I... I don't know why. Either way, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about eating on the podcast. We'll be right back. All right, all day. Yeah, whoa, can't read. I can't read, everybody. All right, everybody. The holidays are always a great time to literally boost your footwear game. You know I love the Boost. The Boost, by the way. Do we even know what Boost is? Boost, like, came from NASA. Google it. Prove me wrong, tell me that there's something better than Boost, and I will literally block you. No, but there is nothing better than Boost. Like, Boost is the jam. Anyway, for the holidays, boost your footwear game and do yourself a favor. Hop over to adidas.com and click on the golf section. Could be a gift get a gift for someone else, y'all. But Adidas makes sure that you can't go wrong. And that's pretty true. Like, I can't find a pair of Adidas shoes that I don't like. Right now, I'm digging the Ryder Cup Special Editions, which obviously you can't get. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that to come out in a douchey way. It's just true. But that style, I actually can't think of the name of the style. I think it's the Tour 360. I love that shoe. It's the most comfortable shoe ever. I'll wear it by the beach. There's the new Addi Power Forged. Ooh, that's a slick shoe, actually. I did get a peek at that. That's on the website right now. Addi Power Forged, and of course, my favorites. Oh, Joel knows my favorites when he writes this. The Tour 360 and the Tour 360 Knit. Tour 360, obviously, you're getting the waterproof full leather upper. Tour 360 Knit, a little more breathable, a little more fresh for the hipsters out there. But they both have all of that, super grippy, sticky spikes, soft spikes. Soft spikes. Don't forget the Addi Cross and Addi Pure. I love the Addi Pure. That is the Justin Rose style. That is the Addi Pure, basically, you can wear anywhere. You can wear it to a tea time or a date, and I promise you're going to get good looks. I hear there's also something new coming early next year, which I'm stoked about. I did hear that. I actually saw that. So watch out, folks. Get ready for that. So go to Adidas or follow Adidas Golf for all the latest news and info at Adidas Golf, ADI. DASGOLF. Yeah, check it out. Get boosted for the holidays, y'all. Later. I think eating on the podcast. Thank you for waiting, everybody. I don't know. I mean, people don't want to hear you eating or me, anyone.
I now understand what you mean. My mother is a lovely, lovely woman, insists on calling from Short Hills with her mouth full of food. And of course, when someone's talking to you with some spaghetti in their mouth, I always tell, I say, Mom, I love you. Can I call you back in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Because I can't handle this.
It's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
See, I used to think it was okay. And I think, I don't know how many comments we got about the eating cookies on the podcast, but I was ultimately like, why do I care? Why do I need to eat? I made the cookies for fun. They're actually gluten-free. But anyway, I don't know why. Anyway, did you like it?
Do you need a hug?
Was the cookie good? No, I don't need a hug. I just want to know if you like the cookies.
C-.
C-. Moving on. Other hobbies? You like gardening?
Yeah, and I'm also Dad the Driver. I like to, when I'm away, I don't get to bring people to ballet and pottery and different. Max has different therapies. Max was born with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And so we used to go to different therapies. He's mostly moved on from that.
How old is he now?
Max is 21.
Wow.
And so I like to drive people to things. Mostly because when you're in the car with me, nothing's going to go wrong as far as accidents and distracted driving and I don't know, whatever goes wrong on the roads in California, a lot of things go wrong, but everything's going to be fine.
What's the car activity? Music, talking, book, on tape? You hang?
Yeah.
What's the average duration of the car ride?
30 minutes, no more.
So it's a real good
coming over the hill. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
We came over the hill yesterday to gymnastics, and once gymnastics starts, I'll go get a car wash or go to the hardware store or do something, or stay and watch some of it. But sometimes they get self-conscious when I stay. So the car ride to and from is great because I get you trapped and we can have stories.
Right. So you've devoted a lot of your free time, not just to golf, but to Down syndrome. You made a charity? Or are you...
I'm on the board of the Global Down Syndrome Foundation in Denver.
Right.
And I'm also a global ambassador for the Special Olympics, and it's our 50th anniversary this year.
Wow.
And so November 30th, I was invited to go down and give a keynote address in Washington, D.C. at a big black tie gala. And so I wrote that piece the other day. And
how long is it? How many pages?
I was supposed to fill 20 minutes. And,
whoa.
Which is, I don't know if you've ever tried to do that, but it's a lot.
That's a lot. And so what is that going to look like for John the actor versus John the activist?
It's really easy to come from truth as an activist for me. And so if I start to share stories about what our needs are and how when people use the word retard and retarded, which we call the R word.
You have a big fight against this word.
Well, we have a campaign called Spread the Word to End the Word at the Special Olympics, crafted by the athletes at the Boise World Winter Games 10 years ago. self-advocates who got together. A component of every World Games is a youth leadership conference. And so it's 200 self-advocates, which you have to almost wrap your head around. It's people with challenges who have the wherewithal and the capacity to advocate for themselves. And so we had athletes from around the planet, from South Africa, from Australia, from England, everywhere, and they were tabling different issues that they found objectionable.
Right.
And the consensus was they were sick and tired of being called and being subjected to the put-downs of the R-word. Mm. And so we start to craft a campaign around it.
Because that's the most offensive thing you can say to someone with a disability like that.
Well, I don't know what the most offensive thing is, but it certainly puts down a population that has never done anything to anybody and is, for the most part, just trying to get through the day. And so when you use that language, the most heinous part is that there's no consequence.
You're saying use that language like as in to describe something that doesn't make any sense, you would call it?
No. So in other words, if you say, boy, Eric was sure acting like a retard. So that perpetuates a negative stigma,
right,
about a population that de facto is less than.
Right. Oh.
Well, that's not fair. And the reason it's not fair is because that population can't return serve. So in other words, if you use the N-word, or if you put down the gay and lesbian community or the Jewish community and say that you're acting like a pejorative word for those groups,
sure,
there will be a tax, a T-A-X. There'll be a consequence for your language.
Yeah.
When you pick on our group, if you knowingly do it, it makes you a punk-ass coward because you've picked the perfect group who can't return serve. And so I want to be the guy who maybe marshals some consequence.
Well, I'm down to do this with you. I'll be honest. I've used that word. I don't know how I've used it, but I don't know. I guess some people say it and you get used to it. Some comedians use it and you're like, well, I can call things retarded.
Right, but you can also do that with black people or Italians or Latins, and there's a consequence.
Right. And so I guess...
You put down black people, there will be a consequence.
Well, and as there should be.
I think. Well, as there should be for the special needs community.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I think it's just...
So what I do, the entrance in there...
You know what, here's one of the things that's kind of interesting is that no one's ever asked me not to use that word. It's just on my conscience to figure that out, which... I don't know. I guess I'm glad we're sitting here.
Well, when I teach at UCLA and USC to the grad screenwriters every once in a while, and one of the topics we table is, isn't there a better way to say what you're trying to say in your script than using the R word? Is that in fact lazy writing?
Oh, because if you must you must run into this word.
Oh, nonstop. Now that I'm tuning your ear to it, it's all you're going to hear.
So when you run into the word professionally, are you like, are you fucking kidding me?
No. My question is there a better way to say that?
And the answer is
say what? And I say the words retard and retarded. And
Whoa.
Then people are like, well, I didn't mean anything. I'm like, oh, because it's super offensive. And
it is super offensive, right?
Beyond.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
And so you don't have to be sorry. You haven't used it in front of me. And so... What I encourage people to do is ask the person using that language, is there a better way to say what you just were saying?
Hmm.
And then a conversation starts. The person invariably goes, what? What did I just say? And the answer is, well, you said that your brother was acting like a retard. And the person was like, well, he was. I'm like, that's really offensive to people who have children who were born with Down syndrome. And they're like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I'm like, you don't have to be sorry. It's just now that you know, it's really offensive.
First one's free. And that's how you operate.
That's cool.
That's cool, man. Because, I mean, the last thing you want to do is dig someone a hole and make them feel like shit. But at the same time...
Yeah, that doesn't work. Since the fact of the matter is, you're legally allowed to use any language you want, unless you're saying a theater's on fire or something. You can disparage black people. You can disparage Jews, gays, lesbians.
You actually
lesbians.
Can? It's not against
Absolutely.
The law to use
no.
anti-Semitic.
You can disparage all those groups.
You
but there will
be
a consequence.
There's a consequence, yeah. Yeah. Wow. There's some... Well, in Germany, it's illegal to deny the Holocaust.
Correct.
But not in America.
In America, you're free. Your right to a freedom of speech entitles you to disparage groups as you please, witness Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And so
it's terrifying.
So, but there's a consequence.
Yeah.
But not with the special needs community.
So we filmed a lot with the, there's a Special Olympics golf team.
Yes.
In Ventura. No, sorry, in Valencia. And I filmed with them. We should actually find that footage. We have it somewhere. We didn't use it, but we filmed with them. I went to a tournament with them. I played golf with them at the Valencia Country Club.
I've never been there. Oh, yes, I did. I shot there once.
Yeah. It's the one on the flats by the five.
I know where that place is.
Can you hear me?
There's a Valencia. There's a Valencia.
TPC.
TPC.
Yeah, that's nice. We didn't play there.
I shot there once.
Yeah. We should find this footage. There's some really good footage from there. And I mean, we just had the best time. And you know, I interviewed the coach of the team. And I said to him, I'm going to improvise here because I can't really remember what the conversation was, but it was very poignant. I said, what is the hardest part, right, for you? And he said, it's watching other people treat the kids differently.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Of course.
Because, I mean, all they probably want to be is the same. Or I don't really, I guess I'm like, can you elaborate? I guess is what I'm wondering.
Well, we talk about inclusion and elevation all the time. And to be included is really what we most prize. So in other words, when I was growing up.
As any human, you mean?
Of course.
Right.
And in the special needs community, we really cherish being included. And then if the bonus is to be elevated, not only to be included, but to be elevated into equality, not necessarily just included, but to be equal, that's heaven. And it rarely happens.
So I guess you must have, or you have three kids.
I do.
Are you full-time with all of them?
Yeah, Max goes between his mom's house and mine.
Right. So I guess with Max, what is like the memory of your relationship that sticks out the most that might sort of include people in your world of what's happened since the day he's been born and sort of the mission you've gone on?
The two funniest things that Max McGinley has done that are immediately accessible to me is that he works down at a Starbucks down in Santa Monica now. And he's kind of a utility infielder slash greeter slash whatever you need. And he has a shadow who helps him. And we have spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on elocution and speech and enunciation, because that's one of our biggest challenges. And by virtue of saturation exposure to the Latin community at Santa Monica High School and our housekeeper, Max only speaks Spanish at Starbucks. So people come in, which is the single greatest thing I've ever heard. People come in and he'll say, hola, señorita bonita, ¿cómo está? And I'm like, what did you just say? Ah, hasta luego. What? You what? There was one?
Right.
It's the greatest thing I've ever heard.
Right.
And I think he got it from a really stunningly amazing Latin community at Santa Monica High, which must have imprinted him and impacted on him in a really positive way. And Maria, who works for us, only speaks to my two daughters in Spanish so that they'll be bilingual by exposure, and it's working. And so Max has picked up on that. And so at Starbucks, he speaks Spanish, which cracks me up.
It sounds really interesting. I mean, it sounds really, I could just see it. I could see it being funny.
The other one is that for the first 10 or 11 years of Max's life, when he'd get on a plane, he had a gag response to it. He would throw up. Whoa. And so you do that two or three times and you're like, okay, we're not flying. And so life was mostly up in Ventura County, Santa Barbara, down to San Diego. That's where we, which is fine in the car because you can go down to, there's all sorts of things to do in San Diego with a kid from whatever you can think of, from Disneyland to the aquarium, to the zoo, to up in Santa Barbara. So it's great. But then one year, Thanksgiving was back in Jersey, and it is every year, but I was like, Nick, come on, we got to go. We got to figure this out. And so I said, okay, to Nicole, my wife, I said, well, Max and I are going to sit up front in first class, see that if that's okay. And Max and Nicole and the baby, Billy Grace, would sit in the back because the baby, it didn't matter with the baby. And so Max and I got on the plane, we took a left, and we got up to the first class, and he was not gagging. And so I'm like, wow, this is great. And so we had every toy on the planet, from a Wii to a DS, whatever you could think of, dolls, anything. And so we get over Chicago, and I'm like, oh, darn, this is going great. And I said, you know what? Let's go back and say hi to Nicole and Billy Grace. And so Max and I get up, and as soon as we go past the coffee station into coach, two seats in, Max turns to a baby in row 12 and just throws up all over the baby. So we turn around. I apologize to the woman and the baby, tried to help, brought Max back up to first, put him down, couldn't have been happier. And so all I can think in my brain is that when you get to see St. Peter at the pearly gates and you know, Max finally gets there after you, and I go, what was it, the throwing up on the plane? And Max would be like, I just wanted to ride in first. I didn't have a problem flying. Yeah. It's just first class is better.
Coach just makes me nauseous. What can I say?
It's the most genius play. I hope that's the play. It would make me so happy if that's the play.
It could be. And maybe there's even a play to the Spanish at Starbucks. There could be even something there that we can't understand.
That'd be great. It makes me really happy.
He's like, I didn't really want to answer any questions.
Right.
Yeah. And Spanish people just, you know, they just... Hi, bye.
It's great.
What do you think is? You know, you spend a lot of time playing golf when you have time.
I do.
What do you? I know kind of what you get out of it. What has it given you? Do you think?
I go to play golf with my brothers in Ireland every. It used to be spring. Now it's late summer. It used to be with my father, which would be the foursome. It'd be my father, Jerry, Mark, and myself. And so what it's given me is a fighting chance against two golfers who are much better than me. And that is beyond satisfying, to be in the hunt.
Right.
So that's what being able to come to Sherwood and grind away so that when I get to Ireland, I have a clue. I have one or two of those swing thoughts working with Jerry Allen, the pro here, who's a great teacher. I have one or two swing thoughts that can keep me in a skins game with Jerry and Mark.
That's
and believe me, being able to be in it and relevant is much more fun than being OB and you're hitting three.
Yeah, that is a very hard way to play. How do you even deal with that? You know, because playing bad golf is harder than just not playing golf.
You had mentioned it out on the course, and it's something my brother Jerry and I talk about all the time, is managing expectations. So on almost every hole there, bogey's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And if a par happens, you're definitely getting a skin. And if birdie happens, that should be great.
Yeah.
Because they don't happen that much. You and I had two birdies today on a par three.
Yeah.
I think birdies should be allowed to be great.
Yeah.
And not, wow, that was really fun. Not that it's really fun. It was extraordinary.
It was pretty incredible.
If you take other things off the board, like eagles, and eagles are not going to happen, mm-hmm. Not in Ireland. It's just not.
Right.
And you're not going to hole anything. And so a birdie, that should be just incredible.
Right.
And that should fill your cup. And then if you're it's funny you said that on the course. I haven't stopped thinking about it. Also in the special needs community, we kind of trade on managing expectations.
What do you mean, trade?
That's how we butter our bread. You have to manage your expectations. If your expectations, my expectations for Max are one thing, uh-huh. and then what Max chooses to do are another. So we got to meet somewhere. And so unless one manages one's expectations, it's going to be an exercise in frustration. And that's not fair. Not not for someone who's trying their hardest.
Right.
And getting through the day. And guess what? Sometimes that's great. That's great.
Is that the biggest thing you learned from that relationship?
No, but the two biggest things I learned from Max is what love is and what patience looks like. And those are two, that love is not cotton candy and unicorns. It's a grind. And it's compensating to sometimes for people who can't compensate for themselves. And it's running an extra lap. And it's an opportunity to be a great parent because you're going to have to be. You have an opportunity to be something great for the first time in your life. Most of us are going to go through life paying the bills, making the car payments, doing a C+, B- job at work. And when you have a kid born with special needs, you got to elevate. You got to do better. You have a chance to be great at something. It's right on a plate. It's right there for you to be great. Because if you're not, this whole thing is going to shit the bed. And so you have a chance to be great at something.
How many people share that perspective?
I don't know, but I speak with a lot of different parental groups, and that's the number one thing that I have to share with them. That most of us, I don't say most of you, most of us, we aspire to be good at stuff. That's pretty much okay. That's going to get you through, whether it's the corporate culture or whatever ladder we're trying to climb, or not get noticed, or don't pick on me, and just let me do my C+ or my B-, and I don't want to bother anyone, so I want to just be okay at this. That's not going to be good enough with a child with special needs and a child born with Down syndrome. You have a chance to be great at something. Great. You get to be a great parent. You're never going to be great at golf. You're never going to be great at scuba diving. You're not going to be great at all this other bullshit. You're going to be a great parent.
And at the end of the day, how do you know?
I don't know what the scorecard is. I think that you have to reconcile that. You have to reconcile that right behind your sternum. You have to. That's a case by case. No one can define the terms of that.
Because golf's pretty simple, right?
Yes. As far as scoring goes, it's pretty simple.
And then what score in golf do you keep track of most?
Well, what's 3 times 18? 54? So par here is 54.
What I mean is...
So I'm always trying to flirt with 54.
But what I mean is... You're writing down your score. When we
yes.
played today, you kept a score. You kept your scorecard. You kept my score. What is that really, though, why you play? To better your score?
I play to get better at golf, yeah. And it's not... I'm not coming out here to masturbate. I'm coming out here to get better at something. And there is a metric out
here
for
it has
getting
occurred to me.
Better at something,
right?
And so, I mean, I've been a 22 handicap, and now I'm, rightfully down at around 12. I wish it was less, but that's about where, that's about where I am.
Right.
And that's I have played, and so I'm Mr. Binge golfer. So when we're shooting, like this year, Stand Against Evil, we're shooting from. We're either doing pre-production from April through the middle of July to the end of July, doing post. So we're shooting for about a month and a half in Georgia, but pre-game is about a month and a half, and post is about a month and a half. And so golf stops.
Hard stop.
Yes, it has to.
That's intense.
And then I dive back in. And I get reacquainted with golf with Jerry Allen, the pro here.
Right.
So you don't get, bad habits. I'm reminded of guys who shoot free throws. You can either shoot free throws with your elbow out and do it wrong, or you can, have your index finger, the last thing to touch the ball, and get that beautiful backspin that guys with a beautiful stroke at the free throw line. I get reacquainted with golf the last couple of years because Stan's been on for 3 years now. I just get with Jerry for the first week or two.
Right.
And just kind of get reacquainted with a path and with tempo. and managing expectations.
You've had 6 hole-in-ones at the Sherwood par 3. Now, I mean, I played it. I was thirsty for a hole-in-one, didn't get one. But, I mean, that's a lot of hole-in-ones.
And I've done 4 of them in front of my teacher, so that felt good.
Wow.
In front of Jerry. So that felt very validating. Because, of course, if I pick up the phone and call my brother, Jerry McGinley, and Mark McGinley, they're going to throw the bullshit card down so fast and make your head spin.
Second ball, whatever it is.
I'm like, dude, call the pro.
Right, right.
Call the stinking pro, you Irish mutts. Call Jerry Allen,
right,
who's never told a lie in his life.
Right. I love that. What, of all the roles you've played in your life, you've played more than 100, what was your favorite? What was it? Not what was your favorite job, not what was your favorite location. What was the character that John was like, this is it. This is my guy.
The hardest thing I ever did was 4 years ago, we did a revival of Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway.
Whoa.
With Al Pacino and Bobby Cannavale and Richard Schiff and
David. Oh, Richard, do you play golf with Schiff ever?
No, but we shared our lives together. We stopped our life and shared our life together for 5 months.
He's the angriest golfer on earth. Moving
Richard
on.
Is?
Oh, yeah. He
one of the best actors on the planet.
He has a second set of clubs in the trunk in case he breaks the entire first set. I'm kidding, but I mean, he's pretty. We play golf together a bunch.
Oh, God, is he a good actor?
Yeah, he's a very good actor.
Well, Richard and I came out on a stage every night for about 17 minutes in the first act of Glengarry, and we just destroyed it.
Awesome.
And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And then because we crushed it so utterly, it was the most satisfying and exciting thing I've ever done.
It's one of the more quotable plays turned movies.
Yes, but you got to remember, Alex's character is not even in the play. He's an offstage threat. And so when people say, it's always such a tell when people go, oh, I love that play. And then they quote Alex's lines. I'm like, it's the movie. You never saw the play, did you? Okay.
Well, I mean, I've only seen 2 plays in my life, so.
Well, if you ever get a chance to see Glengarry, see it. It's astonishing.
I love, I've seen the movie, I think 2 or 3 times.
The movie's very different than the play because the movie unfolds very casually over this rainy night in Chicago.
Yeah.
The play is a fucking hurricane.
Really?
Yeah, the first act is about 32 minutes, and then you're out on, we were at the Schoenfeld on 44th, and so you're out on 44th Street having a cigarette 32 minutes after you sat down, and you don't even know what just happened. And then the second act is about 50 minutes long, and you're done. You're on the train back to Connecticut before 10 o'clock.
Whoa.
It's fantastic. It's thrilling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it is. I mean, even the film itself, it's just, I don't know. I just love the, there's something about the archetype of a salesman, you know, and I don't know what it is, but it's this, I don't know. I mean, you tell me. What is it? What is it about a salesman that we love?
First of all, it's impossible.
Yeah.
To sell somebody something that they don't need, like in Glengarry, another piece of land.
Yeah.
And it's, I think really great salesmen, of which my father was, in the capacity of stocks and bonds and managing people's money, you have to employ every shred of imagination you could possibly muster. And maybe you don't have that much imagination, so you're not going to be that great of a salesman. But there's some magic to it. There's some chicanery. There's some lying. I think that cocktail, you got to mix a bunch of different stuff in there for someone to be, there's some authenticity there's the me having you believe that I'm authentic.
Right.
And that I believe what I'm telling you, which is not different than an actor.
But I was going to say.
What I always tell actors is that what you're doing is a lie. So, in other words, I'm not Dr. Cox. I'm not Stan in Stan Against Evil. I'm not the guy in Platoon. I'm not the guy in Wall Street. Those are characters that Oliver and Dana Gould and Bill Lawrence put on a page. And so if the actors can find a way to reduce the profundity of that lie, whether it's going and trailing at a hospital for 3 weeks and becoming at least familiar with what goes on in a hospital so that the actor can then take that leap and again, reduce the lie, That's what the lens suffers as really good acting. So when Bob De Niro all of a sudden becomes a boxer in Raging Bull, we believe him. He's not a boxer. He's an actor. He's from Lower East Side. He's just this Italian guy. And he became, we believed he was Jake LaMotta. He's not. He's Bob De Niro. And so you believe that I was Sergeant O'Neill in Platoon. I'm not. It's this guy from New York who grew up in Jersey. And so if there's some way, so Oliver put us through that 3-week boot camp in the Philippines so that actors could reduce the scope of that lie. And that's all the lens sees, is you reducing that lie. And then if you can add your truth to it, to the lie, it reduces it even more. And so we believe you even more. And that's all you're doing, is you're just trying to reduce that lie to just a little bit. It's still a lie, but just, the lens only sees a little bit. And that's the trick. And when actors can do that, however they do it, everyone has their different processes, then all of a sudden storytelling becomes super engaging.
I'll be honest, I got kind of sad when you just told me that you're not any of these characters. And no. I'm not an idiot. I know you're not.
I know what you mean.
I know you're not. But there is, it's, well, I guess I'm different, right? Because for me, I host a show where I go be me. I'm not entirely me, but I'm a lot me. And I go here and I'm like, look, I'm interested in this. Let's go look at this. And so if someone comes to me and they say, oh, I love that show, I say, thank you. That means a lot to me. But if someone says, great job on stage the other night, is it really not you? It's your body.
Well, I remember reading a really interesting art. You know those great, when we were growing up, I don't even know if they do them anymore, but when we were growing up, the greatest interviews, written interviews, were the Playboy interviews.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, they
the
were
one
really
with
good.
Brando, the one with Dustin. They were like the best interviews. And I remember reading one that Malkovich did, and John was saying, I've met John through the fourth McGinley, John Cusack. I've met John Malkovich through John a couple of times now. And John talked about, and at the time there was this big argument about Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, the two different schools of method acting in New York. And of course, Malkovich was from Chicago and not really a part of any of that New York scene. And he drew a distinction between, and this is not semantics, about either becoming the character, which De Niro had kind of really been on the tip of the spear of, whether it was Jake LaMotta or and Dustin becoming
Taxi Driver,
with Cruise in that movie, where he really became that person with challenges.
Rain Man.
And Rain Man. Yeah. You know, we believe Dustin had challenges.
Right.
And Malkovich, so they were becoming the character. And Malkovich said, I invite the character to become me. And I found it so interesting. And the question was, well, what do you mean? And Malkovich's answer was, well, I know me better than anyone I can go study. So if I'm going to go study a doctor to play in a movie, I just really want to know how to handle the props. And then I, John Malkovich, know me and the college of eccentricities that I have roaming around in here better than anyone who I could ever possibly try to become. And I ascribe to John's school of that. I invite people into to John McGinley. And if I can pick up a few eccentricities at boot camp with Oliver in the Philippines about being an infantryman, then great. But I'm inviting Sergeant O'Neill in to be John McGinley. Again, that's an ass backwards way of reducing the lie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll buy that. What character do you think you, and we can finish in a second, but what character do you think is the closest to John C. McGinley that you've played?
I guess just by virtue of fatigue and length of run, Dr. Cox would be, just because we did almost 200 episodes, and so what's interesting with actors is when they get tired, those tics and those really interesting things, that limp that you came up with in rehearsal, or that whatever that thing you were going to do with your face, around hour 18 on a set in year 6, that stuff starts to dissipate.
And a lot of improvisation for your character on that role.
No, No.
I read a lot of the subtle back and forth jokes were more or less you made those up.
No, just transitions out of scenes.
Ah, okay.
I would Billy Lawrence, who wrote it. You got to remember, on Scrubs, there was two rooms of seven writers who would leapfrog every episode.
Right.
And then Billy Lawrence, who was the executive producer, would ride roughshod over each episode. And because it was his vision and he was in control. But the people who are populating those two rooms of seven people all went to Harvard, all right. were editors of the Lampoon, all were incredibly gifted men and women who have climbed the uppermost tier of that writing in Hollywood ladder. And so what they put on the page and gave to you for episode seven of season two was really good. And it had to be because there's no time on TV sets, none. You have to pretty much say what's on the page because we gotta go. You're going to shoot 11 pages today, and we're going to do the same thing tomorrow and the next day and the next day, and we're going to shoot into Saturday morning and because we're going to get behind. And so my point is that you can add some of your own flavor, which is improvisation, at the end of the scene to get us out of the scene as a transition. But you really got to connect the dots with what you were handed. And I'm kind of a stickler about that. Because especially now on Stan as the producer, there's no time. And Dana Gould, who's the executive producer on Stan, he ran the Simpsons writers' room for 10 years.
Right.
So that pedigree is indefatigable. It's you can't touch it. You're going to want to say what Dana wrote on the page, and our ensemble has some unbelievably gifted improvisational actors, and I want them to bring their flavor. But after they've said what Dana wrote,
yeah,
and I'm a little pragmatic about it, dogmatic about it. I really want you to say what's on the page, because the show, just like Scrubs, a half hour of television is 21 minutes and 35 seconds. We need to say what's on the page, because we're still going to cut 10 minutes out of what we're shooting. I mean, every time you shoot something, it always comes out to 35 minutes. There's some easy 10-minute cuts. Now we're to 25 minutes. Now we got to do some Sophie's Choice in the editing room, and we got to chop some stuff. And so if you, in your scene, were pretty much just improvising the whole time, it's not going to make it. We might steal that for a later episode, for a storyline. We might borrow from whatever you brought. But the show's 21 minutes and 35 seconds.
Yeah,
that's a blink. And so, no, I did not improvise. I'm not a big improvisational person. I really like to lean in on the writer. I think it's, whether it's David Mamet or Oliver or Dana Gould or Billy, I love to lean in on the writer.
That's great. I mean, those are great writers to lean in on.
Do you think?
I think we're done. Anything else I should ask you?
No, that's fantastic.
That's my favorite question. Any questions for me?
Your death row meal is what? You get your last meal. What is it?
Fried chicken.
And what else?
Mashed potatoes with extra butter.
Yeah.
And a large Coca-Cola with lime.
Nice.
What about you?
I'd probably have a beautiful steak, a grass-fed, organic, beautiful steak with some fries, maybe some asparagus, some kind of beautiful red Montepulciano, delicious Tuscany red, a big, fat joint, like the girth of your thumb, a Philly blunt.
Sorry, make that too.
And I'm not a big dessert guy, so I'm going to get killed. So I don't know. Probably have what do they make up in Northern Ireland? A blackbush on the rocks.
Oh, that's good.
That might call it a. Yeah, that might do the trick.
You know, after hearing yours, I'm going to change mine. I'd like to have a kilo of cocaine.
Right, of course.
And like probably. A couple things of heroin, and then probably just a prostitute. And then I'm good to go. Is that bad?
It's your last meal.
It's my
you can have whatever you want. We're going to kill you in 35 minutes.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, fried chicken all of a sudden seems way less interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show, John.
Cheers.
Appreciate it. See you in the shower, everybody. Hey, gotcha.